The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Champions League, Manchester United are out after forgetting to start yet another football match until they're two goals down. Whose fault is it? How many left-backs is too many? And should we all get Mino Raiola to tell our boss what we really think? Extraordinary scenes in Paris as the game is abandoned after the fourth official is accused of using racist language against an Istanbul player. We'll round up the other games. Is this the last time we'll see Messi and Ronaldo on a pitch together until Soccer Aid 2035? Barney Ronne will join us to discuss the situation at Millwall and we'll look at the World Cup qualifying groups. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Samuel says, have you learned to use a tape recorder yet? Mike says, is this thing on? And Christian says, with three podcasts with atrocious audio quality from your side, when will respected professional journalists refuse to appear on this hobby project of yours? Look, I've got two things recording. I don't know how they work or when they do and when they don't work, but I am currently technologically less competent than Barry, which makes me feel terrible inside. Barry, how do you feel?
I feel fine, thank you.
Oh, good. Also on the panel today, Jordan Jarrett Bryan. Hello, Jordan.
Good morning, mate. You're right.
Aston Villa didn't even have a game, so I don't really know what we're here to talk to you about.
It's redundant me being here, to be honest.
And Jacob Steinberg joins as well. Hey, Jacob.
Hey.
You were at the Chelsea game, which is obviously the big talking point of last night, wasn't it? But forgive us if we don't start there, Jacob.
That's okay.
Let's begin with Leipzig 3, Manchester United 2. Mojo Duffelcoat says, speaking as a United fan, I just knew we'd be knocked out tonight. It's actually got to the stage where I'm actually laughing, admittedly not as much or quite the same way as all of you. We all know Ollie still won't be replaced, even with this. We are in omni shambles, he says. Barry, it must be hard to be a Manchester United fan at the moment.
Yeah, my heart really bleeds for them as a Sunderland fan. I really pity them, those poor football fans. I don't know if it is difficult to be a Manchester United fan. They're fourth in the league. They've just been knocked out of the Champions League and will really fancy their chances, I'm sure, of winning the Europa League now that they've been dumped into that. But it's certainly not dull being a Manchester United fan. Their slowness out of the traps wouldn't win them too many greyhound races, that's for sure. And it's quite baffling how they start games so badly, usually manage to turn it around, and almost turned it around last night, but didn't quite at the very end. They could have got away with it, and we'd probably be having a much different conversation this morning, but it's quite the white knuckle ride. I've always thought Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is not the guy who should be in charge. It's an opinion that hasn't changed despite some good results, but I think his job is completely safe because I think his employers, as long as he can get them into the Champions League each season, going out of the Champions League at an early stage won't be that much of a problem for them.
Does anybody here think that he's the right person for the job?
I don't, and like Barry, I never did think he was the guy for the job. And I wonder if he's doing it on purpose now. Let me go on a really, really bad run. And when I'm on the brink, I'm going to beat City away 3-0. No, I didn't think he was the right guy. I often wonder with Solskjaer what his level is. So if and when Man United do sack him, what job could he and would he get next? Is he a top 10 Premier League manager? Are the managers in the bottom half that are better than him? Would he get a job in Germany or Spain or France? I can't quite work out what his level is and where he would. He's clearly not the level of Manchester United. But I think with United, what we're seeing is they're just not a good team. And I don't care what anyone tells me. I don't care what run they go on. You know, they might beat Man City on the weekend, but they're just not a good team. They haven't been a good team for the best part of 7 years. I think with last night's game, some of the more concerning elements for me are players like Wan-Bissaka, who went there as a really good defensive right back. And he's all over the place. He's not kicked on. He's not being coached clearly there. That would be a concern of mine. I don't buy into the whole Paul Pogba fiasco distracting the team and it played a role in their performance. I think Solskjaer has shown in this campaign that that he's made enough mistakes to show that he's not good enough at this level. Would I sack him off the basis of last night? No, because I tend to think that you should judge teams and managers off their league form. I'm an Arsenal fan, so I'm glad that for 1 week he's taking attention away from my club and my manager. But he's not good enough. But as Barry said, they won't sack him.
Jacob, it's weird, isn't it? The starts they keep making. Angelino's finish was beautiful, wasn't it? And his cross for Herrera was great as well. But this is happening a lot to Manchester United.
Yeah, well, it's happened in the last five away games that they've played in the Premier League. And they've been lucky enough that in those games, they've been playing against, they've been playing against weaker sides. And we saw it on the weekend against West Ham, where they were absolutely appalling in the first half and roughly until around the 55th, 60th minute, by which point they were lucky not to be three or four goals down. You know, they were 1-0 down and West Ham's striker goes through, goes around the goalkeeper and falls over. That's the kind of luck that they've been enjoying in those kind of games. And they've been able to get away with it because against West Ham, you know, they take off people like Cavani and Martial and they're able to bring on two of the best forwards in the world in Bruno Fernandes and Marcus Rashford. And you always kind of thought against that kind of team, you're going to get away with it. The good players are going to bail Solskjaer out. They're going to do something brilliant and they'll win and it will paper over the cracks. Against a team like Leipzig, though, they got punished. And, the 3-0 down, the defending was absolutely appalling. I agree with what Jordan's saying about Wan-Bissaka. When you look at a player like that who came in with a reputation for being a really good defender, you look at the first goal where he's dozing off, the second goal where, again, they're getting down the left and the cross comes in too easily. That kind of defending speaks to me as a team that's being badly coached. When you're seeing that kind of defending and it's getting worse and worse, you know, United are quite good at they're dangerous, aren't they, when they play on the break against big teams and they sit deep and they use the pace. But when you're sort of seeing it in these kind of games and against some of those in some of those away games in the Premier League, and you're seeing the type of defending where they're trying to play a bit more open style of football, and it's just such a shambles at the back, you start to think that they're just being run by quite a bad manager, quite possibly, who's being bailed out by really good forwards, some of the best forwards in Europe. And that seems to be the plan, really, have good players, but it's not sustainable. And that's why it's so inconsistent. That's why you think that while they could challenge for the Premier League with the attacking talent they have, it's probably just not going to happen. And it's really all going to ride on, could they get into the Champions League? Are they able to sort of sustain that? Are they able to get over the defensive weaknesses and force themselves into the top four? But the thing is that there are so many strong teams in the Premier League this season that you think that even that's on the line. I would sack him after last night and Pochettino's available. Go for him and get a proper manager in.
I flagged Wan-Bissaka, but I also think it's important that, because so many people won't, that I flag also Harry Maguire. I've never been a fan of Harry Maguire. I think he's hugely overrated. And some of those goals last night, I just think were embarrassing from his point of view. On BT Sport, they were killing David De Gea, who I thought was poor for the third goal, I believe it was, where he's turned his back. It's awful goalkeeping. But I'm sorry, your centre-half, your captain, your so-called leader, what is he doing? What is he doing? It's so poor. And I don't care what anyone tells me. They are not a good team. They haven't been a good team for about 7 years. And I said that after they beat Southampton 3-2 a couple of weeks ago. And I repeated it last night as well.
Do you care what anyone tells you about anything, Jordan? Or you just don't care?
I just don't care, Max.
Barry, you mentioned the third goal there, Jordan, Justin Kluivert. Between him and his dad, they've scored in all five top European leagues. Joachim says, when you can remember when Patrick Kluivert was young and exciting in the mid-90s, how old should you feel seeing his son score against United?
Well, I know in the Fiverr, our daily tea time email, we used to, back in the day, I'm going back 16 or 17 years here, we used to refer to Kluivert Sr. as Nightclub Patrick because he had a bit of a reputation as a party boy. And his son ain't half the spit of him, I have to say. Like, he really is a ringer for his old man, and not a bad striker either. By the way, sorry, that correspondent, I think his name is Joachim, if he's an Irish guy. I meant to pull you up on this, your pronunciation of his name before.
I do apologise.
Yeah.
I think in the Soccer and Glory, Patrick Kluivert came on with his son, and I can only presume it was Justin, and he kicked a ball through a hole, and he must have been about eight. you know, tiny little man, and now he's scoring goals in the Champions League. I suppose, look, the group wasn't easy. Leipzig are a good team, and PSG are a strange team, but they also have lots of really good players, don't they? But
yeah, but United were in a really good position, and the two games at the start of the group were ones that kind of seemed to be not rescuing the season, but certainly lifting spirits after the really bad start. You know, including that 6-1 defeat to Tottenham at Old Trafford in October, and they got themselves into that great position after winning the first two games, and that seemed to, you know, those are the kind of results which people can cling on to when they, if they are a supporter of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and you know, there are certain pundits in the on television who certainly are, having played with him and like to point at the players more. But then since then, having got themselves into that position, you know, top of the group, just take your pick from the crazy moments in the games that have followed it since then. You know, the counter-attack goal against Istanbul, where if you were playing, you know, Sunday league, you'd be ashamed to concede that goal. Not taking Fred off last week and just sort of thinking, oh yeah, well, maybe with the benefit of hindsight, maybe I should have done that. Maybe I should have taken him off. And he was a red card waiting to happen. And then 3-0 down last night in a game where you only need a point. It's just, yeah, it was a hard group, but they got themselves into that position. And ultimately, they would have gone through if they hadn't lost to one of the weakest teams in the tournament away with, you know, another one of these terrible first half performances, which they've been regularly putting in. Ultimately, you don't get away with it if you keep doing it. And that's what's happening. So can't see anything changing.
Andy says, will any of Ole's former teammates actually criticise him? It's interesting, isn't it? I think I'd find it hard to criticise somebody if I knew them really well and liked them.
You don't find it hard to criticise me.
If I knew them and liked them, Barry, that's the key point in that. Is there a serious point about sort of the art of punditry and the importance of being able to distance yourself?
Well, it's quite obvious that many of Ollie's former teammates are very reluctant to criticise him. Paul Scholes, Rio Ferdinand, certainly Gary Neville's another, Roy Keane leaps to mind too. It depends on how much importance you place in punditry. It's not important. It's people talking about football. What they say doesn't affect the outcome of games. So it really doesn't matter. But I suppose if you want to be taken seriously as a pundit, you should get off the fence and criticise someone, even if they're your mate, if it's the criticism is merited. But once again, it's just punditry. It really doesn't matter.
Just a couple of quick things. Jacob mentions Pochettino is obviously still out of work, and I find it interesting whether or how committed United are to Solskjaer and how long they stick with him. And also, I'm not totally convinced that Pochettino, with what's happening higher up at the board at United level, is dying to go there anyway. Because I think, yes, Man United, big club, but if it's a mess upstairs, how well can you really do? And also, I think a lot of people are shocked that United didn't get through. But at what point do we start looking at Manchester United, the team, as just another team now? And those sorts of results and performances are no longer a shock. At what point do we just accept this is the new Man United? This isn't United of 10 years ago. They're not a good team. Big club, but they're not a good team. I wasn't massively shocked with last night, personally.
Generic Paul Pogba question. His tracksuit wearing super agent Mino Raiola came out, I think he did the interview last week, but it came out on Monday to say Pogba's unhappy and needs to change teams, which is pretty helpful for the situation. If you were Solskjaer, Jacob, what would you do?
I would look to be selling Paul Pogba at this stage. Obviously, they triggered the one-year extensions, so what his contract runs out in 2022 rather than next summer, I think, which obviously protects the value. But it's been, 4 years since he came back to Manchester United from Juventus, and I don't think anybody can really pinpoint a consistent run of games. There are moments, he's obviously a hugely talented player, but it's also been, it's been two managers who've struggled to get the best out of him. I mean, when I was watching him during the West Ham game, you know, the first half he was appalling. And I was just thinking, he may well go on and win this game. and he scored that brilliant equaliser. But at the same time, you're just thinking, this is just emblematic of Manchester United. This is the kind of player who you can't rely on. And although he is going to do brilliant stuff from time to time, the inconsistency means that he's just not worth it. The baggage that's around him with the agent means that there's always going to be drama off the pitch. I don't think that's probably the reason why he didn't play last night. He's been keeping him out of the side for many of these big games. And that in itself is an issue, the fact that he doesn't feel he can trust him to play it and to be disciplined enough and affect the game enough. And Pogba should be really ashamed of the fact that he can't get in the side for this, because he shouldn't be on the bench when players, I know Fred wasn't there last night, but when players like Fred, McTominay, Matic are able to get in the team instead of him, and that's who the manager trusts. I would look to sell him as soon as there's a buyer.
Okay, let's go to PSG Istanbul Basaksehir then. The game will resume today, Wednesday, with a new set of officials after it was abandoned, with the fourth official accused of using a racist term towards one of the away side's backroom staff. Istanbul alleged that the fourth official, Sebastian Coltescu, used the language towards their assistant coach, Pierre Webbo. The former Cameroonian international was shown a red card in an exchange on the touchline. On review of the footage, the referee, Ovidiu Hategan, appears to ask who he should give the red card to from the bench, with the fourth official, Sebastian Coltescu, responding Ala Negru, which in Romanian can translate to the black guy, with reference to Webbo. Istanbul players walked off the pitch in protest, with PSG players following. They were going to resume, but Istanbul weren't happy with Coltescu being moved to be the VAR. There just weren't enough officials in the ground. Stephen says, Erdogan's plastic club teams up with Qatari soft power project. Together they force a reluctant UEFA to match words with action. What the heck is going on? Jordan, it was an extraordinary scene, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And as it was unfolding, I had a really uncomfortable smile on my face. And I say uncomfortable because I don't want any of my brothers and sisters to be racially abused. I know what that feels like, and it's horrid. But there was a slight smile because I thought to myself, finally, after me bleating on and banging on for 4 to 5 years about players walking off pitches, we seem to now be at a point now where boiling point has reached and people are not having it anymore. So I was perversely happy that it happened, because the message it sends out, I think it's the first time in the Champions League there's been a walk-off. I could be wrong there, but I think it's the first time in the Champions League game there's been a walk-off. And you could see with Demba Ba how angry he was. And I was following lots of my black colleagues and friends on Twitter and seeing how supportive they were of the anger that Demba Ba was displaying at what had happened. I also was disappointed to see some ex-players talking about how, oh, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. And, you know, it's I wouldn't be offended by that. Now, listen, everyone has the right to feel how they feel and offer their opinion. But I think when we start playing the almost the racist and the victim Olympics, it's like, well, that type of racism isn't as bad as this type of racism. I think you're in very dangerous territory. Just because we're not calling people the N-word or throwing bananas, that doesn't mean that something isn't racist. I think we have to understand that words are important, and referring to someone as the black man, for me, is unacceptable and offensive. So I was very, very glad to see them walk off the pitch. I hope we see it more and more. And I think off the back of the discussions of what happened at Millwall on the weekend, I think the tension is now building to a point where players are finally understanding their power in this fight against racism.
Jordan, there are people out there who genuinely don't understand what is wrong with referring to a black coach member of coaching staff as the black man. Can you explain what it is that's wrong with it?
Because that coach is a man before he's black, and there's nothing to say that official could not have either pointed better or even walked over to the coach to show the referee, this is the coach I think we should send off. I think, as I say, words matter. And I think when you start referring to people by the colour of their skin, I'm seeing John Barnes already tweeting. He's tweeted a graphic of the coaching staff of the side, and his point being they're all non-black and there's one black guy. The quickest and the easiest way to identify someone is to say the black one. No, we don't do that no more. And I think we have to get to a point where we understand that referring to people as the black one is unacceptable if you don't understand that already. Words matter. Words have an impact. And being described, if I was described as the black one, I would be offended. That would offend me. I'm not the black one. If you don't know my name, come over to me and show the referee it's this guy here I think you should send off. It's very, very simple.
Jordan, how do you think that last night's incident compared to the Cavani post last week?
So I thought that he should be punished for his post as well. I don't know Edinson Cavani, but I don't think there was any malice or any offence intended by what he said. But the reason why I think he should be punished, and it's a similar reason why I think that the official last night should be punished, although these aren't the most overt examples of blatant racism, I think we have to start sending out a message and making examples of any example of where people are racially offended because of racism. What Cavani did, he needs to learn and understand that here, We don't use that sort of language. We don't refer to people like that. That's not what we do here. I spent a lot of time in Latin America working and for pleasure, and I understand the culture there and some of the words they use and how they describe certain black people. It's a part of their vernacular and how they describe and talk about people. That's acceptable because that is their culture. That is their country. I'm going to your environment. But when you come to the UK, you have to understand and be educated that we don't use those words over here. That is offensive to many, many, many people. So whilst many people were saying they give him the benefit of the doubt and that, oh, well, he didn't mean it, there was no malice, I can believe that. I think we have to educate and make people understand that we don't use those words over here. So in terms of ranking it, for me, it's in the same kind of ballpark. But for me, as a black person, it is offensive. And I think there's enough black people that were offended by both incidents to warrant there being a sustainable punishment. What happens here, if from here on in, with UEFA and FIFA, is what's interesting next. How they deal with this, I think, is where I'm looking to see next.
UEFA said in a statement, after discussion with both clubs, decided on an exceptional basis to have the remaining minutes of the match played tomorrow, i.e. today, Wednesday, with a new team of match officials. A thorough investigation on the incident that took place will be opened immediately. Presumably, there does need to be a difference in sanction dependent on malice or, you know, intent or not. Do you think?
That's a good question. I mean, my first thought is, it's a difficult one, that one. I would probably lean towards no, because if we're serious about eradicating racism from the game, we have to understand that just because this is not that, but they're both in the ballpark of being racially offensive, we need to punish those offences. I guess it's a little bit like a foul, you know, being a bit late on someone is different to punching someone in the face on the pitch. One is clearly intentional and warrants a certain punishment, whereas one may be a lesser. So I wouldn't be opposed to some kind of tiering system of punishment of racially offending people. But my big thing is, if it's racist, albeit not overtly racist or intentionally racist, I think it should be punished full stop.
It's one of those things, isn't it, where this referee is not a random person in the stands shouting stuff. He's wearing UEFA tracksuit or whatever, and you know, you're supposed to be, he's in a position of authority and supposed to, you would imagine, be able to communicate with all players. You know, is that just what he thinks that you can do on the touchline, that single out one particular individual because of the colour of their skin? You know, he's representing Europe's governing body. It just seems mad to me. I question whether he should be doing this again, refereeing again.
Yeah, I am. It's like Greg Clark, right? When he lost his job, it was right because he's got to know that's not the language you use, right? And it's similar, although what do I know? On the tiering system, that felt worse to me than, I don't know.
It was, because he's in a senior role, and what was more worrying about that was that I don't think he even realised what he was saying and how offensive it was until afterwards. That was the really concerning thing. But I think the official last night, even if he wasn't intentionally trying to be offensive or racist, a message needs to be sent out now that we don't do that anymore. We don't refer to people as the black man. He needs to be told a lesson, and hopefully here on in, he will learn that lesson.
Can I ask a really stupid question as well? Because I remember in the last part when we were talking about, you know, like sort of terms of reference and the word BAME and that not being, you know, you and Troy were saying, look, I'm black and I want to say I'm black. That I don't know. I've been in sort of situations where two white middle class people are trying to describe somebody who is black and don't say, oh, he's black. And they sort of skirt around it going, he's tall and he's got, you know, dark hair. And I'm, you know, it's just sort of need to know. I don't know if somebody came around, like, let's say we were in the studio and I don't know, it was your birthday, right? And I'd got a cake delivered and someone's going to bring it in. And I went out the studio and this person went, oh, which one's Jordan? If I said, oh, he's the black guy, would that be bad or...
Not necessarily. I don't think referring to me per se as a black man is inherently wrong or offensive. I think in the example of last night, it was offensive because he didn't have to refer to him as a black man. He could have pointed him out. He could have took the referee to him. And that would have been, I think, acceptable. I think if there's no other way of describing someone, he's the guy that's 7'4". All right, fair enough. He's the guy that's, do you know what I mean? Really overweight.
Yeah,
there are other ways of pointing someone out in that example of last night.
Sure. No, it was a torturous analogy. If we are in a studio and it is your birthday, I will get you a cake, though, Jordan.
just don't get him a cake, man. Just on the safe side.
What's your favourite cake, Jordan? Just out of interest.
Actually, I love a lemon drizzle.
Right. Okay.
And a carrot cake, for future reference.
All right, you want two cakes, do you?
I'm greedy.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at Stamford Bridge. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Frank Lampard made 10 changes to the side that beat Leeds at the weekend. First senior start to Tino Angerin, while Billy Gilmore made his first start since recovering from injury. They drew 1-1 with Krasnodar. Adam says, does anyone have anything to say about the Chelsea game, or was everyone watching Man United? Jacob, you had the dream ticket. You were there.
Yeah, it was really cold.
tell us about Gilmore, because last season I thought he was so good.
Yeah, he was. He was really good when he came into the team last season. He was one of the reasons that the form, particularly at home, kind of turned around when he came into the team for the out of the blue for the Liverpool Cup game, which was these two games just before lockdown against Liverpool and Everton, which they won. They beat Liverpool 2-0. They smashed Everton 4-0, and this 19-year-old kid just came in and. Out of nowhere and just completely ran midfield against two good sides. And then he after lockdown he got that injury against Crystal Palace, which was a shame because I think that Lampard loves him and really wanted to give him a good run of games in the team. But he came back last night. He'd had 5 minutes off the bench against Sevilla last week, and last night was the first start. Dead rubber game, not against a particularly strong opposition, but you know, straight into it, running the show in midfield, you know, great passing, couldn't get close to him at times. The ball always seems to come to him in midfield. He always seems to be in the right place. So really wouldn't be surprised to see him get a long run of games now when it's possible, because obviously they've been playing very well with the first choice midfield. He'll want to do it though, because obviously Scotland got to the Euros, so he'll need to play.
He'll be good against us.
Yeah, I mean, he's been in the under-21 squad, and he got that crazy red card in his first game back for the under-21s, the Scotland under-21s last month, which was a bit of a shame. It wasn't a red card, and that was obviously frustrating for him. But he'll hope that he gets enough games for Chelsea that means he can get into the senior side.
You watch a lot of Chelsea, Jacob. The chat on the pod hasn't been overly positive towards Lampard. I mean, do you want a Mason Mount a defence? Sorry.
what have you been saying?
Well, Jonathan Wilson, you know, thinks Lampard's not a very good manager, and they get exposed at set pieces and on the counter. And I think there's probably a feeling here that in a bit like with Solskjaer, all his old mates are nice about him and all Lampard's mates have been too nice about him. So there's been a reaction. I've found that reaction a bit too much because I just want to sit on the fence about everything. So I've gone full circle again. But I just wonder if having watched him, you think there is a, you know, a, talented manager there and doing good things.
I think unlike Manchester United, I think that you can see obvious progress. So last season, they had the transfer ban. He had to throw in the kids. And I think that a lot of people were expecting Chelsea not to finish in the top four last season. Wouldn't have been surprised if they'd gone out the Champions League group. They got to the last 16. Obviously, they got smashed by Bayern Munich, but so did many other teams. And they finished in the top four. And that was a perfectly acceptable return for his first season in charge. He's inexperienced, so he's always going to make mistakes. But you know, this season, you can see the progression. They've started defending better. They aren't getting caught on the counter. You know, when they played that game against Tottenham, they very much realised what Tottenham would want to do and made sure that they weren't vulnerable to it. And every time people say something critical about Chelsea, they actually seem to answer some of the questions. So after they, you know, it was, I think after that Southampton game where they drew 3-3, people were talking about the bad defending since then with the players that he actually wants in the team, in the side. They've sorted that out. So after that, it was, well, can they defend and attack at the same time? Since then, they've been blowing teams away with, you know, coming through to that 4-0 against Sevilla last week. I mean, it's still early days, so you know, can they win the league? I think it might be beyond them this season. I still expect Liverpool to kind of once they get Van Dijk back and Alisson back, that they'll most are away with it. But I think he's doing a good job. I think there's a reaction to Lampard because of the way he got the job, and probably there was resistance to him probably from his England days as well. And some people don't like him, but I think he's doing fine, to be honest.
Joseph says, what's your favourite post moment on the pitch camera shot? Mine has to be whenever a Chelsea player misses a header, the instant pan to see Giroud's reaction. It's hard to look past cutting to Sir Alex in the crowd at Old Trafford, you know, after any Manchester United manager of the past 7 years side has conceded a rubbish goal or lost a game or just done something, just existed, isn't it? I don't know if anyone has any advances on that. Elsewhere in that group, Sevilla won 3-1 at Rennes. So those two are the sides that go through. Chelsea win the group. Group G, Juventus won 3-0 at Barcelona. Could be the last time Ronaldo and Messi took to the same pitch. Barry, should producer Silas be fired for suggesting this question? Does this game prove that Ronaldo is the GOAT and not Messi?
It doesn't prove that, no.
More importantly, should Silas be fired for even putting that in the script?
I think that would be harsh.
Okay.
And given our recent production problems, I think we need all the help we can get. I'm willing to give him a pass. Not that it's within my remit to have him dismissed.
I suppose what I'm trying to find is, what question can I ask about Ronaldo and Messi that isn't a hackneyed cliche, but that's the sort of most interesting part of
this game. The thing about that is Messi is playing in a team that's struggling really badly and Ronaldo isn't. They've both adopted their games as the years have progressed and they've become less able to run. And I would argue that Ronaldo has possibly adapted his better, but they are both terrific players. I prefer Messi, and that is all I have to say on the matter.
So you hate Ronaldo, basically?
Clearly, yes.
I'm with Barry. I'm Team Messi as well. But it's really sad watching Messi the last couple of years. Whenever you watch him, it just seems like he doesn't. I don't know. I just feel sorry for him now. He doesn't.
It's forlorn.
Yeah, it's really. I just watch him and just think, you don't give me joy, and I don't think he's enjoying football, mainly for the reasons that maybe Barry has flagged, that he's not in a very good team, and there's only so long you can carry a team for. But it's really, really, his career seems to be ending on a bit of a whimper, which for me, as a big fan of his, is quite sad to see.
Juventus are the first Italian side to score 3 or more away at Barcelona in a UEFA competition. Ronaldo, the first player in Champions League history to score 2 penalties against Barcelona in the same match. Weston McKennie, one of the best names in football at the moment. Quincy Promise, for me, is leading that competition with a great scissor kick. And Bonucci celebrated like Tardelli for bundling in one that was then disallowed. Here's a question for you, Jordan. Oh, Barry.
Sorry, I just before you move on, Max, I have to say, one of the reasons I dislike Ronaldo, and there were quite a few, is that goal celebration of his is just diabolical. And it's particularly diabolical in an empty stadium with this prancing off to the corner and then doing his little pirouette and the loud hoo.
Isn't it C? I thought it was C.
Whatever it is.
Yeah. What would you do, Barry?
I think I'd be old school Shearer style. Just one arm up and run away. Superman
not shirt,
style.
I think not gigs in the semi-final, shirt off, wheeling it round your head.
Well, I'd get booked for that, wouldn't I? And I'd almost certainly have picked up a yellow card previously, so that would be the end of my involvement. And I don't have the chest rug to carry that one off.
You could go for your top and just put it over your head, but not take it off completely.
Yeah, I'd probably then run into the goalpost or something.
Anyway, here's a question for you, Jordan. William says, serious question. Ooh. Who would win between Arsenal and Barcelona? Sounds so daft, but the more you think about it,
I think Barcelona, well, they would, because even though I've just said that Messi's not, you know, he's not playing at his best, Messi at 70% is still good enough to run rings around my club. That is a easy one for me. Barca.
Okay. Dynamo Kiev beat French Forest 1-0 in the other game in this group. So Juve win the group. Barcelona second. Group F, Lazio 2, Bruges 2. Crazy end to this game. They were 2-1 up, Lazio, playing against 10 men. They conceded a goal, 2-2, and in injury time, or just at the end of the game, De Ketelaere, if I've pronounced that correctly, smashed the ball against the underside of the bar. But they made it through. Pepe Reina's in goal for Lazio, for those of you that didn't know that. He did a very good make a mistake and yell at everyone else for Bruges' first goal. Dortmund won 2-1 at Zenit. They needed to win to be sure, winning the group, and they did that despite going a goal behind. Borussia Dortmund's Youssoufa Moukoko, 16 years and 18 days, became the youngest player to feature in a Champions League match when he came on as a substitute. Barry, you look desperate.
That just makes me sad. Like, I'm 31 years older than him. That is just so depressing. Being 31 years older than someone who's playing Champions League football.
Number one on his birthday was Vertigo by U2. Anyway, you'll be all right, Barry. Don't worry about it.
Well, number one on my birthday was Come On, Feel the Noise by Slade. And that's going to take some beating by anyone.
Okay, yeah. What have you got back, Moukoko, to that? I'm sure he'll get in touch. Right, that'll do for part two. Barney Ronay will join us to talk about Millwall QPR last night. And we'll do that in just a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's discuss the situation at New Den. Millwall drew 1-1 with QPR last night. The Millwall players didn't take a knee. Some QPR players did. Barney Ronay is a Millwall fan and has done lots of work with the club, saving the New Den. I don't know if that's going too far, Barney, had a big role in that. How are you doing, Barney?
I'm okay. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. This question was from E. Lewis, who says, has there been a more breathtakingly dangerous, cowardly, cynical response to racism in football than Millwall QPR pandering to racists by gaslighting those resisting them with a kick it out banner for media points? Joel says, did Millwall just bow to fan pressure in not kneeling, or was the decision made by the players for other reasons? Barney, I don't know if those questions are valid. What do you think?
I mean, the initial booing of the taking of the knee, that kind of just really, that was terrible. I mean, I felt pretty sick for a few days after that, to be honest. It's very difficult. Obviously, we expect everybody to share the same politics on this. That's the way things are now. We're very polarized. I'm going to try to see the other side here. I mean, the initial booing was just so offensive. Like, the idea this was about protecting the world from Marxists has been sort of circulated afterwards, that there's this terrible problem with Marxism threatening our way of life, and we need to, like Senator McCarthy in the 1950s, we need to fight this. I mean, that was clearly kind of not correct. And I kind of wish, in a way, those people had tried to explain their actions by simply saying what I think is the truth. That people don't like to be told what to do. And even though you kind of move from one echo chamber to another, there are a lot of people in football who, football fans, people who go to matches, who actually don't want people to take a knee. That is the truth. There are people who have different views on this. And that, I guess, was always going to come out somewhere. It came out there. It came out at Colchester. And it is important to accept that. And I think that the reaction where you just say everybody involved in this is absolute scum and a fascist is as extreme as, well, as extreme. It comes from the same place as being so discourteous and idiotic as to boo, you know, over somebody else's peaceful, entirely peaceful gesture in support of discrimination. It's kind of wrong. It's wrong to take that attitude because we completely dismiss what happened there and we don't learn anything from it. Why did they do a kind of clapping circle afterwards? Well, they did it to reflect that fact, I suppose. And the fact that people will boo and always boo at things. And we live in a world where you can boo other people's opinions if you want, even if it makes you, it puts you historically in the wrong and also on the wrong side of something that is actually a crime in this country, racial abuse. Not that that was racial abuse. It's very complicated. I don't know what will happen now. I'm really glad that there was at least a respectful moment there and that people were allowed to actually do what is a peaceful gesture and harms nobody and doesn't deserve to be booed by anyone. But football and society really does need to address this issue. We need to understand that there is hostility and opposition here. And while it's very convenient and easy to locate all racism in one place and to say, if we just closed down the den, we would conquer racism. That's clearly not true. Football clubs aren't repositories of thought, despite all the talk about Marxism and you know, the idea that this was some sort of concerted response. These are people who come in from our society and leave and go back into our society. And I am still much more concerned and much more worried about the racism of empowered and powerful people who decide how people feel in our society. I'm much more bothered about the racism of the last 10 years of our government than I am by some people who, quite frankly, are quite confused and quite angry and have taken a place in the culture wars that obviously is very upsetting, but doesn't actually have any power. And is, in a sense, a response to the conditions around them. We had a government minister saying that this was fine. That's far more concerning to me because that person has power. And sorry, I'm ranting on about this because it's such a confusing issue and it's so upsetting. And I really do wish that we could get somewhere other than simply pointing at each other and playing the game of who's the fascist, which doesn't really help.
I found what Barney was saying there about trying to see the other point of view and see the other perspective. I did the similar thing. I think it was the smart thing to do. We can all rant and we can all, you know, condemn people that booed the kneeing, and I was doing that. But I thought, okay, let me try and rationale maybe why they did it and what they're saying. And as I've seen it and the kind of the rhetoric from certain broadcasters and ex-players that I've heard from the last few days to try and justify or defend their right to boo taking the knee, it just feels to me like it's wrapped in them hiding behind the fact that they are most likely racist. And this excuse, and I see it as an excuse of, oh no, we can boo the taking of the knee because, well, you know, it's linked to a Marxist organization and, you know, defunding of the police and these people are radicals and that's why we're booing it. That's why we're booing it. And that for me is not good enough because for me, it's been very clear that the taking of the knee is a sign of solidarity against racism and anti-discrimination. Now, I'm someone, I came on this podcast 6 months ago, Max. I'm not even pro taking the knee and I never was pro taking the knee. That's just my personal stance. But I found it interesting last night that Millwall, and I don't know if I'm missing something here, that the Millwall players didn't take the knee. They thought standing was the way to respond to what happened on Saturday. And I just thought, well, hang on a minute. Surely, if as a club you do stand for anti-racism, you don't align yourself with those small section of people that booed on Saturday and you're going to then need to show that No. This is, we are with the rest of the football community in doing this. And as I say, I'm not even pro taking the knee, but it felt to me like that was the thing that they should have done. I found it bizarre that they thought that standing was the best antidote to those supporters that turned up on Saturday. So I've tried to kind of see the other side of it, but I can't see a rationale that makes sense to me other than that, really.
Yeah, I mean, just to be clear, trying to see the other side of it is just because otherwise, like, where do you go? Obviously, all that stuff about why we're doing this is, it's an excuse. Like, if you can look at that gesture and boo it, there's something seriously wrong. I mean, I've been going off and on to the Den for 35 years, and the moments of progress and triumph when you realise that, okay, some things have got better, that this place is starting to reflect the area around it. And to see that, I mean, that just pisses all over all of that. I mean, you're just not going to go to the, you're just not going to go there anymore. You're not going to think this is not a place where I am welcome, where my kids are welcome. This is a peaceful gesture of inclusion that really just cheers people up, and you've just screamed across it. And that, you know, there's no way around it. And trying to sort of see why that might happen, it's just the fact that this is what we have. I mean, this is what we have in our society. This is what we're, this is where we are. And it's not just a few people. There's a lot of people out there who feel so hostile to something like that, that they're going to express these views. And I don't really know how we progress past that without trying to, understand it, I guess.
It felt to me that the applause that went around the New Den yesterday was clapping because their team wasn't taking the knee, I suppose. And that felt wrong to me. I appreciate, and I don't know what you think, Barney, like, the club and the people at the club are in an incredibly difficult situation. That doesn't mean they've done everything right, but I imagine it is very hard for them when what they're trying to do is just get people in a ground and try and have a good football team, that this is difficult to deal with.
Well, yeah, but the club needs to lead on this. I mean, what do we want football clubs to do? Do we want them to try and play both sides and placate people? Or do we want them to try and lead and set an example? There is a kind of backstory to this, that what happened is people at Millwall, some of the fans had expressed that they just didn't like the taking of the knee, that they obviously got these concerns about what they see as a violent political organisation threatening their way of life, which is in fact a small fringe organisation that has absolutely no power, but never mind that. And there was a Remembrance Day thing, which is quite a big thing at Millwall, Remembrance Game. It's quite a big thing there. It always has been. There's strong ties to the military and veterans charities and things. And there was a request put in that, can we just have that as the Veterans Day? Can we just do the bugle and the, the commemoration of that? And the club said, no, we're going to do both. We're going to do the taking of the knee and that. But then, as I understand it, I wasn't there. There was a mistake before play and the playing of the bugle didn't actually happen. They took the knee and then sort of went ahead. It was a mistake by the referee. I understand this is unconfirmed. And a lot of but the point is that story got out. And a lot of the fans were very annoyed by that and annoyed with the club. And that, in part, the booing, it sort of comes out of this microclimate of feeling that your thing has been pushed aside for this thing, the thing I really care about. And so you've got this microclimate of people annoyed and inflamed by that, whether that's right or wrong. And feeling that the club has been sort of trying to play both sides. The club also got in touch with some fans and tried to sort of explain that, well, we're doing this because we have to. I mean, this is all on the Millwall message boards. We're doing this because we have to, in a way, kind of trying to distance themselves from what the EFL wants them to do, but then put a statement out before, on the Friday before the game, we're taking the knee, was booed, saying we're going to do this. And I think the club has been very unclear and hasn't handled this well. And at a time like this, you do need a bit of leadership. And people sometimes just need to be told that this is right and this is what you're going to do. And that didn't happen.
Barney, thanks for your time.
Cheers, bye.
Millwall, in their statement released before the QPR game, said Millwall have a zero tolerance policy against racial and all other forms of discrimination and want to again make clear to anybody who holds such views that you're not welcome at this football club. Millwall's stance, as always, is that anybody found guilty of racial abuse is banned for life. Moving forward, the club and its community trust have started the first ever audit of board members, staff, volunteers and participants as part of an ongoing commitment towards equality, diversity and inclusion in all areas of operations. On top of a push towards ensuring the entire Millwall workforce is fully representative of its diverse local community, the trust will continue their outstanding and industry-leading work around anti-discrimination within the boroughs of Southwark, Lewisham and most importantly, further afield. This will still include programmes and projects within primary and secondary schools and colleges as education, the club believes, is the most important driver in ridding society of discrimination of all kinds. Moving on, the 2022 FIFA World Cup qualifying groups were announced. Barry, are you upset that Ireland didn't get Denmark?
No Denmark, no Wales. So got to consider that a result. We have, however, got Qatar, I believe. So that's someone new.
Yeah, Qatar are coming in. It's like Australia in Eurovision, isn't it? They're coming in. But unlike Australia can win and have won Eurovision, I believe, Qatar are just playing friendlies. Also, you've got Portugal, Serbia, Luxembourg and Azerbaijan. David says 55 teams are taking part in World Cup qualifying from Europe for 2022. In 1990, pre the breakup of the USSR and Yugoslavia, it was 32. Does Mikhail Gorbachev get off too lightly for his contribution to fixture pile-up? How angry will Jurgen Klopp be with perestroika? Is that what it was? England are in a group with Poland. Again, they played Poland quite a lot. Hungary, Albania, Andorra and San Marino. Wales are in with Belgium, Czech Republic, Belarus and Estonia. And Northern Ireland are Italy, Switzerland, Bulgaria and Lithuania. And Scotland are in with Denmark, Austria, Israel again. Good for them. The Faroe Islands and Moldova. There was a discussion about, I saw you having a nice chat with Adrian Durham on Twitter, Barry, about the idea of pre-qualifying for the smaller nations so that, say, England don't have to play six games against Albania, Andorra and San Marino. And actually, I don't. Why?
Oh, God. I mean,
go on then. I'm just typical arrogant English, I know. Carry
yes.
on.
Yes. Well, I had a row with, not a row, because they're two guys I like, but Adrian Durham and Bruce Millington works for the Racing Post, and they think England shouldn't have to muddy their spats on the pitches of these minnow nations they consider beneath them. And Adrian Durham seemed quite perplexed by the fact that some people considered this view arrogant, when in fact it is almost the dictionary definition of arrogance. These games might be a drag for England. They might not be hugely important to England because England generally win them. But I would argue that a team with a record of so many high-profile banana slips in their football curriculum vitae aren't really in a position to decide who is good enough to play them. And I would also argue that while these matches may not be important to England, they're very important to the Minnow Nations in terms of prestige and money. And Durham, of course, did his usual thing of constructing a straw man argument, saying that I hate the English and that's my reason. But, you know, these games, no domestic tournaments have ever been curtailed because of England had to play too many World Cup qualifiers. So, yeah, I'm glad to see that you share this arrogant view, Max, that England are so brilliant at football that while they haven't won anything since 1966, they really shouldn't have to muddy their spats against the likes of Andorra or Liechtenstein.
They won Le Tournoi in 1997.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you,
respect
Jacob.
That, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And they won a lot of World Cup qualifying groups. So.
Ian Wright scored that brilliant goal from that Scholes sort of pass with backspin. So, yeah. Oh, thanks for coming to my defence, Jacob. Greatly appreciated. Barry, you went to Dulwich Hamlet, you old hipster, yesterday.
Yes.
Did you go for the football or because you could have a pint without having a substantial Scotch egg?
A bit of both, to be honest. Yeah, myself and some mates went, It's a good excuse to get out for a few pints. Didn't have to have a substantial meal, but we did have to watch a substantial football match. I had a great time, as did, I suspect, 1,027 other people who were there. It was bloody cold, but apart from that, it was tremendous fun. It's quite funny, actually, because I freely admit the game was on and it occurred to me that I did not know a single name of any of the 22 players on the pitch, but it was an entertaining game. Good night out.
It's like you watching West Brom, Barry.
Yeah, West Brom against West Brom under 23s. And just to get out of the flat, Max, and go and do something was fun.
Simon says, does Jordan still think Arteta's a better manager than Dean Smith? Here we go.
It's not going very well for Arteta. My defence is waning week on week. First of all, yes, in answer to the question, I do think he's a better manager, but he's struggling. He's definitely... Why are you laughing, Max?
Because I don't know what you're basing it on. It's just baseless.
I'm just kind of trenched now in stubbornness now until he wins another couple of games. Do you want me to elaborate?
You're allowed to change your mind. It's legal to change your mind.
No.
I think it's like the pod's attitude towards Frank Lampard. We're in so deep now, you just have to keep going.
I'm seeing it through.
Luke says, perhaps a mention on the irony of Jurgen Klopp moaning about broadcasters while accepting a paycheck for their adverts. Yeah, in an advert for Amazon, one of the people that someone answers the door to Jurgen Klopp handing them an Amazon box. But at no point in the advert does Jurgen Klopp say, here's this, but not at midday, please. I only want 5:30 or maybe 4 on a Sunday. No early kickoffs. Then you can have the box. Darren says, on this subject, my side, Racing Club Femenino had a game against River Plate Femenino at 9 a.m. on Tuesday morning. What is the worst kickoff time you've ever had? Well, that is early, isn't it? Eddie says, is Barry's boiler working? And has he recovered from his elderly fall down the stairs, ba-dum, 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 as his ass bumped on the stairs all the way down?
Yes is the answer to both those questions.
And Ben Fleethammer says, any chance Barry might do a rendition of I Do Anything for Love, but instead listing all of the places he would and wouldn't go to. After you said you would go to Australia for love, someone suggested going to Australia for love, you saying, actually, I won't go past Oval for love.
I'll have to go and work on that. My options are limited, really. It's I will stay in Brixton or go to Stockwell, Oval, Kennington at a push, but not Elephant and Castle.
Right. We're obviously still looking for permission from Carly Rae Jepsen before we get on to asking Meatloaf for anything. You know, one at a time, I would suggest. And that's pretty much all we have time for today. Jordan, thank you so much for your time.
Anytime.
I hope we get you a birthday cake. Jacob, cheers for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
And we're back tomorrow. Seem surprised, I should know this by now, but yeah, we're back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.